A 30-something woman arrives at the ER, her life slipping away despite our frantic efforts. She's gone in minutes. Meanwhile, down the hall, a cancer patient fights a battle that's been quietly raging in his body for years. These two deaths, one sudden, one slow, taught me something crucial early in my medical training. We've become remarkably good at emergency interventions, but tragically poor at prevention. We're like firefighters who've mastered putting out blazes, but never learned to check the smoke detectors. Here's what keeps me up at night. That sudden heart attack? It's not sudden at all. The disease process has been progressing silently for decades, like termites eating away at a house's foundation. My own wake-up call came after swimming 21 miles across the ocean, an achievement that should have marked peak fitness. Instead, my wife's comment about my weight led to blood tests revealing insulin resistance and dangerously low testosterone. With a family history of men dying from heart disease in their 40s, I realized I was sprinting toward the same cliff. This moment sparked an obsession that would reshape how I understood health entirely. We're treating chronic diseases far too late, waiting for arbitrary thresholds, instead of addressing the metabolic dysfunction that begins years, sometimes decades, before diagnosis. Prevention isn't passive, it's actively choosing to intervene before disaster strikes. Delivering devastating financial news to bank executives in 2007, I watched denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance flash across their faces in minutes. My detour from medicine to McKinsey taught me to think about risk analytically rather than emotionally, a skill medicine desperately needed. Medicine has evolved through distinct eras. Medicine 2.0 brought germ theory, antibiotics, vaccines, conquering infectious diseases like polio and smallpox. But these tools have made limited progress against the chronic diseases now killing us: heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, diabetes. Medicine 3.0 requires a philosophical shift. Build the ark before the flood. Treat each person as unique rather than applying cookie-cutter protocols. Sometimes the riskiest choice is doing nothing. Jean Calment lived to 122, potentially marking humanity's upper limit. But centenarians aren't just living longer, they're living better longer. Cancer strikes most people at 72, but centenarians at 100. They experience compression of morbidity, staying healthy until near the end, then declining briefly rather than suffering decades of disability. Centenarians possess a genetic time shift. At 60, their coronary arteries resemble those of 35-year-olds. Having a centenarian sibling makes you 8 to 17 times more likely to reach 100. Remarkably, older adults who exercised regularly for 6 months developed more youthful gene expression. While our genome is fixed at birth, gene expression responds to how we live. Centenarians show what's biologically possible. Our task is mimicking their advantages through deliberate action. During my surgical residency, I encountered a patient whose liver looked diseased, like an alcoholic's, except he rarely drank. This mysterious condition, which we barely understood in the 1980s, now affects more than 1 in 4 people globally: fatty liver disease. It perfectly symbolizes our modern predicament: bodies designed for scarcity, drowning in abundance. Here's the crucial insight: obesity and metabolic dysfunction aren't synonymous. About 1/3 of obese individuals are metabolically healthy, while 20 to 40% of normal weight adults are metabolically unhealthy. In that latter group faces triple the mortality risk. What matters isn't the scale, but what's happening inside your cells. Your liver maintains exactly 1 teaspoon of glucose in your bloodstream. Half a teaspoon more signals diabetes. When subcutaneous fat capacity is exceeded, excess energy infiltrates dangerous locations: the liver, causing fatty liver, muscle tissue, causing insulin resistance, and around vital organs as inflammatory visceral fat. Insulin resistance likely begins when fat infiltrates muscle, disrupting cellular signaling. Cells become deaf to insulin, so the pancreas compensates by producing more, creating a vicious cycle. Once vanishingly rare, diabetes now affects over 11% of U.S. adults, with another 38% pre-diabetic. Heart disease killed my uncles at 46, 42, and 69. My father needed a coronary stent in his 60s. Despite excellent cholesterol and healthy habits, my genetic predisposition put me at high risk. In my mid-30s, a cardiac CT scan revealed I had the arteries of someone 20 years older, placing me in the 75 to 90th percentile for my age, despite being fit enough to swim 21 miles across the Catalina Channel. The medical advice? Do nothing. Heart disease is simultaneously our most prevalent age-related condition and more preventable than cancer or Alzheimer's. We understand its progression, have effective medications, and possess diagnostic tools. Yet, it remains America's leading killer, claiming roughly 2,300 lives daily. The problem is timing. Cardiovascular risk guidelines operate on too short a horizon. Atherosclerosis begins when ApoB-tagged lipoproteins penetrate arterial walls, triggering immune responses that form plaque, a process that can start in teenagers. The key isn't just LDL cholesterol, but the number of ApoB particles circulating in your bloodstream. Prevention should begin in your 30s or 40s, not wait until traditional risk factors emerge. Looking at 30-year rather than 10-year horizons dramatically improves outcomes. If you adopt only one habit, make it exercise. Just 90 minutes weekly reduces all-cause mortality risk by 14%, outperforming most pharmaceuticals. For the 77% of Americans who don't exercise, this represents the single most powerful intervention available. Peak aerobic fitness, VO2 max, may be the strongest longevity marker. A 2018 study of over 120,000 people found poor cardiorespiratory fitness carries greater mortality risk than smoking. Moving from the bottom fitness quartile to just below average cuts mortality risk nearly in half. Muscle strength rivals cardio in importance. People over 50 with low muscle mass have 40 to 50% greater mortality risk. Men with hypertension in the top third of strength had 48% lower mortality than those in the bottom third, regardless of cardio fitness. Exercise acts like a powerful drug. Muscles generate cytokines that strengthen immunity and stimulate growth. Endurance activities produce brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, improving memory and preserving brain volume, crucial for Alzheimer's prevention. Train like a deck athlete, excel across multiple domains rather than specializing in just one. My friend Sophie's story haunts me. Active in retirement, playing golf, gardening, she suffered shoulder and knee injuries requiring surgery. Her activity plummeted. Depression followed, then rapid cognitive decline. What killed her wasn't just pneumonia, but decades of aging's gravitational pull working against her body. I realized my own fitness was problematic. Cycling through obsessive phases with boxing, running, swimming, and cycling, always taking each to extremes. I was one-dimensional, high VO2 max, but lacking strength, flexibility, balance, and stability. Sophie's death changed my perspective. The solution? Adopting a deck athlete's philosophy for aging, what I call the centenarian decathlon. This framework organizes physical aspirations for later decades, representing the 10 most important tasks you want to perform throughout life: swimming half a mile, carrying heavy dumbbells, performing pull-ups, climbing stairs rapidly, dead hanging, hiking with a backpack, carrying luggage, walking steep hills. The centenarian decathlon is deliberately ambitious but achievable. Octogenarians and centenarians run marathons, race bicycles, and compete in actual decathlons. Jack LaLanne maintained rigorous daily workouts until his death at 96. We must stop pointlessly exercising and start training specifically to become exceptional centenarians, like archers who train at 100 yards, becoming more accurate at 50. During medical residency, I averaged 120 weekly work hours, believing sleep was expendable. I nearly died falling asleep at a traffic light after 3 days straight. Another time, I woke in Baltimore's Patterson Park, surrounded by drug paraphernalia. Despite these close calls, I still opposed reducing resident work hours. Years passed before I understood sleep's vital importance. If it weren't essential, natural selection would have eliminated it. My chronic sleep debt produced elevated insulin, high triglycerides, and bottom percentile testosterone, not just from poor diet, but from a decade of severe deprivation. Even short-term sleep loss causes profound damage. Healthy young people restricted to 4.5 hours for 4 days developed insulin levels matching obese diabetics. Poor sleep activates permanent fight or flight mode, explaining the 6 to 26% higher cardiovascular disease risk. During deep sleep, the brain flushes harmful proteins like amyloid beta and tau. Optimal sleep requires darkness, avoiding blue light that blocks melatonin, and cool temperatures around 65°F. Alcohol severely disrupts sleep architecture, despite initially sedating, while caffeine's 6-hour half-life means afternoon consumption impacts sleep onset. Your body isn't a machine to optimize. It's the vessel through which you experience everything meaningful. Train it to remain capable of activities that bring joy at 90. My obsession with living longer stemmed from fear of death, yet ironically prevented me from truly living. The breakthrough came when I realized that all the protocols meant nothing if my life remained damaged by unaddressed trauma and emotional dysfunction.